Hi there. Just a quick note that if you're hearing this, it means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed. I encourage you to become a Misfit right now and immediately unlock every single full-length episode that I've ever done, and you can immediately start learning from some of the greatest entrepreneurs in history. It is absolutely insane how much you can learn for such a small investment, but don't take my word for it. Let me just read a couple of the testimonials from Misfits. It says, I just paid for my first premium podcast subscription for Founders Podcast. Learning from those who came before us is one of the highest value ways to invest time. David does his homework and exponentially improves my efficiency by focusing on the most valuable lessons. Another person said, I stumbled upon this podcast. After one episode, I quickly joined the Misfit feed since $5 a month is the equivalent of a few cups of coffee for great detailed biographies on amazing leaders. I love the insights and thoughts shared along the way. David loves what he does and it shines through on the podcast. Definitely my go-to podcast now. And just one more before I get into today's preview. It is worth every penny. I cannot put into words how fantastic this podcast is. Just stop reading this and get the full access now. I agree with every single one of them, obviously. I hope you do as well. If you do, tap the link that's in the show notes on your podcast player or go to founderspodcast.com. It takes less than a minute to set up and you can start learning from some of the greatest minds in history. I reached the top of the arc and began to level off. I could have shaken hands with Lord Jesus. 80,000 feet. A nighttime sky with flickering stars at 10 in the morning. Up there, with only a wisp of an atmosphere, steering an airplane was like driving on slick ice. I dropped my nose slightly to pick up more speed and watched the meter register Mach 2.2, then Mach 2.3. I was accelerating at 31 miles per hour per second, approaching 1,650 miles per hour, the fastest any pilot had yet flown, and the fastest that any straight-winged airplane would ever fly. My outside wing began to rise. I put in full aileron against it, but nothing happened. The thought smacked me. Too high, too fast, Yeager. I might have added, too late, Christ. We began going haywire. The wing kept coming up, and I was powerless to keep from rolling over. And then we started going in four different directions at once, careening all over the sky, snapping and rolling and spinning in what pilots called going divergent on all three axes. I called it hell. I was crashing around in that cockpit, slamming violently from side to side, front to back, battered to the point where I was too stunned to think. Terrifying. The thought flashed. I lost my tail. I've had it. G-forces yanked me upwards with such force that my helmet cracked the canopy. Without my seat straps, I probably would have blasted right through the glass. My pressure suit suddenly inflated with a loud hiss. I was gasping, and my faceplate fogged. Blinded, being pounded to death, I wondered where in the Sierra Mountains I was about to drill a hole. We were spinning down through the sky like a frisbee. Desperate to see, I groped to the right of the instrument panel, trying to find the switch to turn up the heat in my faceplate. But then the ship snapped violently back on itself, slamming me against the control stick and somehow hooking my helmet onto it. As I struggled to get free, I had glimpses of light and dark, through the fog visor. Sun, ground, spinning down. I had less than a minute left. Through some sixth sense, I remembered that the stabilizer was set at leading edge full down, and I could find the switch in the dark. Still fogged over, I reached for it and retrimmed it. Still groping, I found the rheostat and the heat flicked on. My faceplate cleared and I saw more than I wanted to. I was spinning into the Sierras. Without even thinking, I set the controls with the spin. The ship flipped into a normal spin at 30,000 feet. I knew how to get out of that. I had spun every airplane imaginable, including the X-1, at 25,000 feet. I popped out of the spin. I radioed to Ridley. My voice was so breathless and desperate that I doubted he could understand me. Down to 25,000 feet. I don't know whether or not I can get back. I can't say much more. I've got to save myself. I didn't know what was going on. I was so dazed and battered, I wondered if I could still fly. And I worried if the airplane could still carry me. I sobbed. I barely remember the next moments. But then my head cleared and I was at 5,000 feet, lining up with the lake bed. I was gliding in from the other side of the Mojave, doing 270 miles per hour, and I started to believe I was going to make it. The lake bed filled my windshield, and I put her down a little hard, with a thump and a cloud of dust. But no landing in my life was as sweet as that one. The flight data would later reveal that I had spun down 51,000 feet in 51 seconds. I survived on sheer instinct and pure luck. That is what it's like to almost die testing jets, and it comes from the book that I want to talk to you about today, which is Yeager, an autobiography by General Chuck Yeager. So before I jump into the rest of the book, just a quick note on, I want to talk to you real quick about Founders Postscript. I started a secondary podcast feed for all the books that I read that are not biographies as a way to incentivize people to sign up for annual plans. I got to make a change. I added so much complexity. This week, I spent so much time answering emails, DMs, dealing with this added level of complexity. I had the thought while this was, this is time I should have spent obviously reading books and making podcasts and doing the things that you actually want me to do, right? And I had the thought while all this was going on, I said, you know what, if Steve Jobs was here, if he could come back from his grave and see what I did this week, he'd smack me in the face. So what I'm just going to do is, even though I wanted to find a way to incentivize people to upgrade to annual plans, it's the best way to support founders, I don't want hassle and I don't want complexity. So I'm going to leave the link for the new podcast feed. It's just going to be a benefit for anybody that has access to the Misfit, whether you're paying monthly, annually, whatever the case is. That's just the simplest way for me to do it. You'll find it in the show notes in your podcast player down below. Just grab the feed. I'll leave instructions on how to add it to. It's pretty easy. You can do it in, you know, usually less than 30 seconds. And that's that. That's just the most simple way. It's just a way for me to continue to add value and to say thank you for supporting me and founders. All right, so with that out of the way, let me jump right into this book. I absolutely love this book. I could recommend reading it right off the bat. I have a ton of highlights, so let's get into it. There's a lot to learn. I guess I should back up. How did I find this book? Chuck recently died at 97 years old. I had followed him on Twitter forever. He was this hilarious old man that spoke very frankly, very, very brutally. but he was fantastic on Twitter. And you read his bio, you know, he broke the sound barrier, was the first person to become an ace in a day, in a single day in World War II. Just had all kinds of, he just lived an amazing life and had all kinds of accomplishments. He was one of the greatest, if not the greatest single pilot to ever live. And a lot of the ideas and that he discovered through trial and error through his very long career are ideas that you could apply to whatever it is that you do, whatever it is that your craft. And so that's why I think he's worthy of study. And this autobiography I held in my hand is very old. It's, I think it was published first in 1986. It has sold millions and millions of copies. It's very highly rated, and I could see why. It was a fantastic book. The same way the 90-year-old Chuck was on Twitter. He's 62 when he writes this book. He just writes, there's no fluff here. So let me just jump into a little bit about his early life and a shocking tragedy. One thing to know about Chuck is he grew up in, you know, West Virginia. He's like, he calls himself a hillbilly, and he felt that he had to work extra hard throughout his entire life to overcome the prejudice. You know, he could, when you hear him speak later on, he sounded fine, but the twang that he had in his voice, especially early in his life, people had a hard time understanding him. So it says, we lived in Myra on the upper Mud River, which is just a few farmhouses. He's describing the little town. I don't even know if you could call it a town. It's like a settlement, which is just a few farmhouses, a post office, and a country store. Our house stood next to a cornfield. When I was about three, we moved to Hubble, where Dad went to work for the railroad. I remember him coming home with his face and hands bandaged from a flash fire when he shoveled coal into the firebox. As young as I was, that incident made a deep impression. I realized for the first time how hard he struggled to shelter us from the cold. You know, he's talking about he's got an older brother and a little sister. He says, Roy, that's his older brother, and I slept in the family room on a studio couch that opened into a bed. By then, we had a two-year-old baby sister, Doris Ann. Shortly before Christmas, when I was 4 and a half and Roy was 6, we were sitting on the floor in the family room playing with Dad's 12-gauge shotgun. Roy found some shells and loaded the gun. He accidentally fired, and the baby was killed. For our little family, it was a time of terrible shock, loss, and suffering. I'm sure Roy carried this heartbreak with him until his own early death from a heart attack at age 41. He and I never again discussed it, nor did my parents. Years later, Glennis, that's Chuck's wife, asked my mother about the accident, but she didn't want to talk about it. That's the Yeager way. We keep our hurts to ourselves. So now he talks a little bit about his mom and her contribution to him growing up. She cooked us mush for breakfast, which was plain boiled white cornmeal served in a bowl with milk and sugar. She made more than we used and set it aside until it got rubbery. Then she sliced it, fried it, put butter on it, and that was supper. Some evenings, we'd only have cornbread and buttermilk. By the time I was 6, I knew how to hunt squirrel and rabbit. I'd get up around dawn, head into the woods, and bring back 3 or 4 squirrels, skin them, and leave them in a bucket of water for mom to cook for supper. I actually use that example in my own life. My daughter was complaining about having to put some clothes away, and she's 8 years old. And I just very calmly said, I was like, when you were 6 years old, did you have to get up at dawn and go into the woods and hunt and kill squirrels, skin them, and leave them in a bucket for dinner because you had nothing else to eat? She's like, what? I was like, yeah, you don't really have that much to complain about. On a few pages later, this is just what I love about the way he writes. This is just 4 short sentences, and he tells an entire story. You have an idea of who he was, who he was. We ran barefoot all summer. Dad was gone all week. He came home on the weekends. I cannot remember a moment when there wasn't something to do. And here's some more short sentences that tell entire stories. I was a competitive kid. I always tried to do my best. I never thought of myself as being poor or deprived in any way. We managed to scrape by. Kids learned self-sufficiency. Mom and Dad taught us by example. They never complained. I had certain standards that I lived by. Whatever I did, I was determined to do the best I could at it. And I think those sentences give you an idea of his early childhood. Now we're going to get to the point where he's graduating high school. He's going to join the military. And on this page, there's several ideas that we have seen before. Let me read them to you, and then I'll tell you how they relate to other founders that we've studied in the past. I never thought of going to college, but I was always eager to acquire practical knowledge about things that interested me. That was a big reason for my success as a pilot. I flew more than anybody else, and there wasn't a thing about an airplane that didn't fascinate me down to the smallest bolt. So that's just one sentence, and those are 2 ideas that we've seen before. One, I flew more than anybody else, and I always recommend Arnold Schwarzenegger's fantastic autobiography. It's like 500 pages. I can give you the main idea in 3 words. Reps, reps, reps. That was Founders number 141, if you haven't gone back to listen to that. And what Arnold keeps preaching in that over and over again is you have to put in the time. I did thousands and thousands and thousands of reps, his bodybuilding career, but learning how to speak English, learning how to be an actor, learning anything he was doing. It's just time and time and time. So that's what Yeager says throughout the book. I flew more than anybody else. He says that over and over and over again. And then that second idea. And there wasn't a thing about an airplane that didn't fascinate me down to the smallest bolt. We saw that before Samuels or Murray, back on Founders number 37, the book, The Fish That Ate the Whale. His quote that I read in that book, I haven't forgotten. I probably did that book, 2 years ago? There is no problem you cannot solve if you understand your business from A to Z. And Chuck will reference that over and over again, the fact that he saved his life multiple times because not only did he learn how to fly, but he learned how the plane worked. And he compares and contrasts his approach with other pilots that only learned how to fly, didn't care, outsourced the idea that to the mechanics and cost them their lives. So it says, I flew more than anybody else, and there wasn't a thing about an airplane that didn't fascinate me down to the smallest bolt. Back to his personality. I'm stubborn and strong-willed and opinionated as hell. Yeah, that's for sure if you read his Twitter feed. And this is another good idea here. As hard as Dad worked, he enjoyed it, and that was an important lesson too. Tramping alone through the woods with a rifle or in a cockpit with a throttle in my hands, that's where I was the happiest, and that's how I wanted to live my life. Okay, so I'm going to fast forward to where he starts learning how to fly. This is March 1943, and there's a couple of things happening on this page. There's a description of his training, but it's also if you have the right job or not. So it says, you're whipping through the desert canyon at 300 miles per hour. your belly just barely scraping the rocks, your hand on the throttle. It's a crystal clear morning on the desert of Western Nevada, and the joy of flying, the sense of speed and exhilaration 20 feet above the deck, makes you so damn happy that you want to shout for joy. A hill rises ahead, and you ease back, skim over the top of it, dropping down above cottonwoods lining the bank of a stream. You feel so lucky, so blessed to be a fighter pilot. Now a little bit about the training. We live surrounded by the Nevada sand dunes in tar paper shacks, belching black smoke from the oil-burning stoves that only warm themselves on cold desert nights. The wind never stopped blowing, and the chow was awful, but none of us complained. We flew from dawn to dusk, 6 flights a day, 6 days a week. Dogfighting, buzzing, and practicing gunnery. We crawled exhausted into the sack at 10 o'clock at night and straggled to breakfast at 4:30 in the morning. I logged 100 hours of flying that first month. Hog heaven. Now, what's most interesting about that is this is not something he had planned for his life at all. In fact, Chuck says over and over again in the book, he's like, I'm not ambitious. I just decided to take the most interesting thing that was right in front of me, but I didn't plan very far ahead. So this is about how it didn't really start that way. I had never dreamt of being an aviator. Me? I was a pool hustler from West Virginia. He's talking about his life right before joining the army, or the military rather. Before running chores, playing pool in the pool hall, or poker under, or excuse me, between. Between running chores, playing pool in the pool hall, or poker under a covered bridge at the edge of town, and catting around with 3 or 4 different gals, there wasn't a hell of a lot going on in my life in the summer of 1941, when an Army Air Corps recruiter came to town. I enlisted for a 2-year hitch. I thought I might enjoy it and see some of the world. So he starts off not as a pilot. He says, I became an airplane mechanic. But after taking my first airplane ride, I'd rather have crawled across the country than go back up. So this is very interesting. He got so sick. He's like, I'm never going to, I don't know ever want to be in a plane again. I took off for a spin with a maintenance officer flight testing a ship that I had serviced. And I threw up all over the back seat, staggering out of that damn thing as miserable as I'd ever been. But teenagers blot out the past when the present seems appealing. What a great sentence. I saw a notice announcing a flying sergeant program. I'd take my chances with flying to become a sergeant. Flying became fun. Being cocky and competitive, I began bouncing other students and staging mock dogfights. I could line up on air or ground targets before others in the class even saw them. My instructor knew who was the best in the group, and in the end, I was the one he recommended to become a fighter pilot. I was thrilled. So Chuck starts as a fighter pilot, and then he's after World War II, he's going to start testing experimental planes and then experimental jets, right? And so just like when we studied Enzo Ferrari, Carroll Shelby, I think this is back in like the late founders 90s, somewhere in there, they were at the cutting edge of racing cars, and a lot of people were dying. The books are just full of people dying. This is the same thing at this time. There's, you know, you could start off with maybe a class of 30, and you'd be lucky if half of them survived. They don't call it dying, though. They call it auguring in or buying the farm. So if you hear me use those terms, he means dying. But what I found interesting is he's talking about how stupidity is leading to death. And I want to relate this to what Charlie Munger said. So first, here's Yeager. Yeager says, in nearly every case, the worst pilots died by their own stupidity. So Charlie Munger has this idea where he's just like, avoiding stupidity is actually a skill that you can cultivate, and it's much more important skill than trying to be brilliant. So let me read, there's an interview that he gave, that Charlie Munger gave, and he was asked the question, it's like, why isn't Berkshire easy to emulate? You know, you have simple ideas, but why don't more people copy what you're doing? And this is what Charlie said. It was very fascinating. He says, we're talking about very simple ideas of just figuring out the standard stupidities and avoiding them. And I actually collect them, meaning he collects human stupidities. Some people collect stamps. I collect insanities and absurdities. And then I avoid them. And it's amazing how well it works. Because I've gone by the examples of all these people that are more talented than I am. Charlie's also describes himself as a biography nut. He's read hundreds and hundreds of biographies throughout his life. If I had to set out to invent more quantum mechanics, I would have been an also-ran. I just set out to avoid the standard stupidities, and I've done a lot better than many people who mastered quantum mechanics. It's a way for mediocre people to get ahead, and it's not much of a secret either. Just avoid all the standard stupidities. There are so many of them, and so many brilliant people do it. Being a prodigy is hard. I'm not trying to be a prodigy. I'm just trying to avoid the insanities, including the insanities of prodigies. That enables a man of moderate abilities and moderate work habits to get so much more than his logical deserts. Think of the talent it takes to make a lot of money. And so that's when I'm reading Chuck Yeager, I'm hearing Charlie Munger at the same time, that you should avoid stupidity. Stupidity will get you killed in Chuck's line of work. In Charlie's line of work, stupidity can make you go broke, can make you deeply unhappy, it can cause a lot of pain to yourself and those around you. So avoid stupidity. It is a skill you can cultivate. I love that. Now, this is the second part of what's happening on this page is, the note I left myself is, humans are capable of dark psychological states. Let me read this to you. He's talking about the training to become a fighter pilot to serve in World War II, okay? A gruesome weeding out process was taking place. Those who were killed in Nevada were likely to have been killed in combat. But those of us who did survive the training were rapidly becoming skilled combat pilots and a cohesive team. I turned my back on lousy flyers as if their mistakes were catching. When one of them became a grease spot on the tarmac, I almost felt relieved. Think about what a crazy sentence that is. That is a dark psychological state. It is way better to bury a weak sister in training than in combat, where he might not only bust his ass, but do something that would bust two or three other asses in addition to his own. So what he did later in the book, and later in flight history, they start having to be refueled in midair by these giant bombers. So you have this giant plane, there might be 10 people on board, and you have a fighter pilot that has to get up underneath them. You might have seen this before, and they refuel. And he says, you know, if you make a mistake, if you're a stupid pilot at that point, not only, you know, you killed yourself, you damaged ruined a very expensive plane. But in some cases, he calls this guy an idiot. He says one idiot took out an entire bomber and the 10 people on board. So not only did he make a mistake, it cost his life, but he lost two planes and 11 souls. So this is, if you read what Chuck is saying here without context, it seems very like dark and extreme, and it definitely is. But when you put it into the context of, it's not just this guy's life that's at stake, but it's everybody around him. It makes sense why he's so brutal, I guess is the word I would use here. So it says, where he might not only bust his ass, but do something with bust two or three other asses in addition to his own. But I got mad at the dead, angry at them for dying so young and so senselessly. That's another point of this book. You know, there's no 97-year-old fighter pilots. These are young, even by the time he's in his 30s. You know, he still flies all the time. That never stops. But he keeps getting promoted, so he's teaching more. And they consider it a young man's game. You're talking, you know, when he was serving in World War II, the person leading him was 25 years old. And they thought this guy was old because they were young. You know, he's 19, 20, 21 years old. Extremely young when he's doing this. Anger was my defense mechanism. I lost count of how many good friends have augured in over the years. But either you become calloused or you crack. Shooting down an airplane seemed an incredible feat. I had no idea why the German people were stuck with Hitler and the Nazis, and I could care less. History was not one of my strong subjects. But when the time came, I would hammer those Germans any chance I got. Them or me. Even a D history student knew that it was always better to be the hammer than the nail. So now it talks about just the kind of people that would be attracted to becoming fighter pilots. They are wild, and being wild makes them happy. And this is an example of that. Those 6 months of squadron training were the happiest that I've ever been. That is a hell of a statement. He lived an amazing life filled, you know, he still has got a third of his life to go when he published this book. But even if he ended it at 62, he lived many, many multiple lifetimes compared to the average person. And he says, those 6 months of my squadron training were the happiest I've ever been. Now that I was a fighter pilot, I couldn't imagine being anything else. Again, another sign that you have a great job, or that you have the right job, rather. We were hell-raising fighter jocks with plenty of swagger. So let me actually stop there, because I shouldn't be so flippant. Like, let's spend some more time on that comment. Now that I was a fighter pilot, I couldn't imagine being anything else. That's a great simple system or simple way to figure out if you're doing what you're meant to do in life. You can't imagine being anything else. We were hell-raising fighter jocks with plenty of swagger. When we weren't flying, we zipped out on our leather flight we zipped out on our leather flight jackets and told the world who we were. On paydays, we crowded around the blackjack tables, drank ourselves blind on bourbon, and staggered over to the local cat house. So it talks about they got in trouble in this cat house, which is a bordello, a brothel, I guess is a more common term. It's in this little town in Mena, and they were causing so much trouble that they called the cops on them. It says, but we went to Mena anyways, wrecked the place, and the sheriff ran us out of town. Okay, so cops saying, get out of here. What does this guy do? The next morning, a P-39, that's the plane that he's flying, strafed Mina's water tower. So he goes back, and they call it sometimes they call it strafing, sometimes they call it buzzing, but it's getting the aircraft so low that people on the ground feel the vibrations and the sound is just extremely loud. It's unpleasant. And so, yeah, you might have kicked me out of town, but I'm coming back the next day, and I'm coming back with my fighter plane. It's just insane. So I started the podcast with the most harrowing experience that he ever had, but he almost died multiple times. I'm going to share another example of him almost dying that took place maybe a decade before the accident at the beginning of the podcast. Okay, so it says, before then, I almost bought the farm. That's another euphemism for dying, right? Our fighter group staged a mock attack, and I was indicating about 400 miles per hour when there was a roaring explosion in the back of the aircraft. Fire came out from under my seat, and the airplane flew apart in different directions. I jumped for it. When the chute opened, I was knocked unconscious. A sheep herder found me in the hills and tossed me across his donkey face down. My back was fractured, and it hurt like hell. So I think he was 20. He was 20 years old when that happened to him. Now, this is he just met the woman that's soon to be his wife. They were married for like 45 years before she died of cancer. And this is his wife's description of Chuck at this time. And I think this is a description of Chuck, but it could go for almost any person that we've studied in this podcast. I sensed that he was a very strong and determined person, a poor boy who had started with nothing and would show the world what he was really made of. Okay, so let's fast forward. World War II. I forgot to mention his list of accomplishments. He gets shot down, survives, walks across the mountains into Spain, and then is the first pilot to be allowed back. And this all makes sense as I continue to read this section. Free falling, flat on my back, spinning from 16,000 feet, velocity doubling each second. Hold off. Get below the clouds where the Krauts, that's what he calls the Germans, can't see the chute. Yank that cord now and you're dead. German strafe guys floating down. Clouds whisk past. French countryside filling horizon. Even so, wait, goddammit. Ground rushing up. Occupied territory. Two fingers grip the chute ring. Corner of my eye. Ground closing in. Smell forest and field below. Now! I yank the ripcord ring. The parachute blossoms, breaking my fall, and I'm rocking gently in the winter sky. Below me, the hills and fields are crawling with Germans. I see the black smoke from my airplane wreckage and sweat the slow ride down. I'm easy target practice from the ground. I hear a dogfight raging far above me, the chattering machine guns and roaring engines of dozens of fighter planes spinning across the sky. I'm dropping down over southern France on a deceptively peaceful countryside. Trees rush up at me. I reach out and grab onto the top of a 20-foot pine. I bounce a couple of times on that limber, leaning it over to the ground, and just as I did as a kid in West Virginia when we ride pines for miles through the woods. In only seconds, I'm 6 inches from the ground. I step down, gather in my parachute to use later as shelter, and limp off into the woods. There's blood on my pant leg, blood on my torn leather gloves, and blood dripping down the front of my flying jacket from my head. The woods are dark and still, but even as I move deeper into them, I hear the distant rumble of army vehicles and the sounds of voices shouting in German. They pick you up fast in occupied territory, before the locals can hide you. The bastards saw me coming down. It is slightly past noon on Sunday, March 5th, 1944, and I'm a wounded 21-year-old American fighter pilot, shot down and on the run. So let's go into what he does next. I study a map of Europe that is sewn into our flight suits. Man, I can't believe how fast luck changes in war. Now you got to remember this part for later. But whatever happens for me, the war is over. If I make it home, no more combat. And this is very surprising to me. A rule meant to predict to protect the French underground from pilots they assisted who might later be shot down again and tortured by the Gestapo into revealing escape networks. So there's this, all these French resistance fighters that are hidden out in France, that German, obviously this occupied territory, Germany's controlling France at this moment. And so they're going to have, these are the people that actually wind up helping Yeager escape to Spain. But the problem is, you know, if let's say he goes back up, a year from now, he gets shot back down, but this time the Germans get him. Well, they'll torture him, and then under torture, he's liable to say, hey, this is where they are, this is their networks, this is how they travel, this is how they're getting fed, all the other stuff. So this is the rule where he's like, damn, all I want to do is fighter pilot, and now the not only may I not survive this, I might die, I might freeze to death, it's cold, you know, I could be killed, I could be turned in for money, but what I wanted to do is taken away from me. I'm never going to get this opportunity again. So this kind of compounds. I'm trying to tell you all this background to, if you put yourself in his position, just imagine not only the physical anguish, but the mental anguish that he's having to endure at this moment. So far, none of the guys shot down in my squadron had been able to make it back. Now, remember this for later, though. He winds up making it back, and it's part of that where his wife was just describing, his insane levels of determination and persistence, and just, he's stubborn as a mule. He says, I peek out to see, so he's hiding in the bushes. This part reminds me of this the fantastic book I just read, Andy Grove's autobiography, Swimming Across. So he says, I peek out and see a woodcutter shouldering a heavy axe. Remember, this is a French guy, okay? I decide to rush him from behind and get the axe, killing him if necessary. He's not going to kill the guy, don't worry. I jump him and he drops the axe, almost dead with fright. With eyes the size of quarters, he stares at the pistol I'm waving in his face. He speaks no English, so I talk to him like Tarzan. Me, American. Need help. Find underground. He jabbers back in excited French, and if I understand right, he tells me that he will go find somebody who speaks English. I read his face, which is scared but friendly. Remember, the French... I mean, he understands what's likely to happen. Yeah, some French people would turn him in. The French did not want the Germans in their country, and they realized the Americans, British, all these people are trying to help get the Germans out. So it's in my own interest to help them. So he hurries back off into the forest after signaling to me to stay hidden and wait for him to get back. I keep his axe and watch him run off, wondering if I should take off or wait for him. Can I trust this guy? Long before I see them, I hear returning footsteps. Definitely more than one person. It's been more than an hour since the woodcutter took off. My pistol is pointing at the path. So what he does is, instead of hiding in the bushes where the French guy thought he was, he smartly goes across the way, because they're going to run up to the bushes, thinks where he is. He's going to be able to see them before, in case it's a setup, he'll be able to see them before they see him, right? My pistol is pointing at the path. I won't get very far if he's brought a squad of German soldiers. I'm burrowed into the wet ground, my heart thudding like a 500-pound bomb on the as the footsteps stop. My impulse is to turn tail and run, but I check it. Then I hear a voice calling to me in a whisper. American, a friend is here. Come out. I can't. This is such an interesting... Because again, put yourself in his shoes. I can't see them, and it takes all my courage to slowly pick myself up. It takes all my courage to slowly pick myself up. That's a fantastic sentence. I'm on the opposite side of the path from where the woodcutter left me. My .45 is aiming at the back of an old man staring into the brush. The woodcutter is with him. Silently, I move forward. Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you want to continue listening to the full episode, you'll need to upgrade to the Misfit feed. By upgrading, you'll get access to every full episode that I've ever done. These episodes are available nowhere else, And as a bonus, you also get lifetime access to my notebook that contains key insights from over 285 podcasts and lectures on entrepreneurship. As a way to illustrate why it is so important for you to learn the lessons from all the biographies that I analyze on the Misfit feed, I have some quotes that I've collected from other people who have discovered the value in reading biographies, and they explain to you and I why this activity is so valuable. So the first quote comes from the founder of Shopify, Toby Lütke, and he says, "Books are the closest you will ever come to finding cheat codes for real life. You can access the entire learnings of someone else's career in a few hours." This quote from Marc Andreessen on why he reads biographies. "There are thousands of years in history in which lots and lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology. They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these ideas down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. There is so much more to learn from the past than we often realize. You could productively spend your time reading experiences of great people who have come before you and learn every time." And finally, this quote from the book, The Tao of Charlie Munger, on why Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett have both read hundreds of biographies in their lifetime. "Reading personal biographies allows one to experience multiple lives and successes and failures. Reading business biographies allows one to experience the vicissitudes of a business and learn how problems were solved. Both Charlie and Warren are copious readers of personal and business biographies." So upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com.